What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is John Ben Asher, talking about Jewish day schools. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Rosh Hashanah is almost here. The Jewish New Year arriving this coming Wednesday night and Thursday to herald the new year of 5775. It's a time of tshuva, of personal reflection, repentance, and return. When we turn our hearts to the task of improving our lives morally and spiritually, this is a great time of year for Jews, the Yamim Noraim, literally the highest of the holy days. If you haven't yet made arrangements for where you're going to go for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur for services, you should do so, immediately, for synagogues are usually full on the high holy days. Some of those folks only come on these days, but they wouldn't miss Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur for any reason. It's the most important time of year for Jews, and the most powerful and most moving. To help you prepare properly, we're continuing our preview of the music of these high holy days. This is the Unetane Tokef. We observe the mighty holiness of this day, which is one of awe and trembling before God. From the Danzig Tradition CD, this is the choir of the Great Synagogue of Jerusalem, Cantor Naftali Hershtick, the Unetane Tokef. That was Unetane Tokef for Rosh Hashanah and the Days of Awe, Yom Kippur as well, coming soon to a temple near you. By the way, Cantor Hershtick was a teacher of mine in Jerusalem many years ago. In the spirit of reflection created by these coming High Holy Days, I've been thinking lately about the Middle East, the entire regional quagmire that captivates so much of our media's attention and has required the involvement of our U.S. government and military on a pretty permanent basis for at least the past 13 years, ever since 9/11. You know, you cannot look at a news feed today without seeing stories about ISIS brutality, beheadings, and the American military response. And if you look more broadly at the ongoing wars in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, at Iran's nuclear ambitions, civil unrest in Egypt, Libya, and Yemen, and the refugee crisis now engulfing Jordan and Turkey, you know that the Middle East is a mess yet again, and that America is again deeply involved in Middle Eastern wars and their consequences. If you take the long view, the global historical perspective that I prefer, there are two elements driving our perennial enmeshment in this pivotal, tumultuous area. And by the way, neither one involves Israel, really. The first has been America's profound economic dependence on oil. And the second is the long process within the Muslim world itself, particularly in the Middle East, in which a series of societies have moved from colonial occupation to secular dictatorship and then, unfortunately, towards religiously radical self-determination. There have been dalliances with true nationalism and even some vague democracies along the way, but essentially this process, with some reversals, has been playing itself out through the Middle East for 35 years and more, and it will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. And America will keep getting sucked into it. Let's start by looking at the oil part of the equation. Although in recent years, America has finally begun to reduce and even eliminate its dependence on Middle Eastern oil, for most of the second half of the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century, Middle Eastern oil has been a huge part of our economy and our global strategy. Almost all Middle East states are either rich oil producers with money literally to burn, or poor states dependent on their oil-producing brethren for funding. Europe, Japan, China, and of course America are still heavily dependent on oil and gas from Middle Eastern sources, as is the global market, which is highly sensitive to changes in supply, controlled mostly by OPEC. Two-thirds of the world's proven crude oil reserves are still in Muslim countries in the Middle East. And through OPEC, the amount released to the world largely controls the price of oil. None of this has changed very much since the first oil crises way back in the 1970s. The money provided by oil revenue, which was predicted to run out by now, is flowing as strongly as ever into the coffers of Middle East oil producers like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, Kuwait, Libya, and even complicated cases like Iraq and Iran. This huge flow of money has allowed the leaders of all of these countries to focus on things other than their immediate economic needs. Those needs are largely provided for, at least at some level, by the black gold lying under the oil countries' lands and in their waters. None of this is recent news. These oil kingdoms, sheikhdoms, and other petrodependent societies have mostly been this way for a century, and they took the form most of them still have way back in the 70s. But the huge financial windfall that the enormous growth in the use of oil worldwide has provided for these nations has not exempted them from the other major Middle Eastern movement of the past 35 years. There have been lots of wars in the Persian Gulf over those 3.5 decades that were about oil. You can make a strong case, in fact, that since the late 70s, the Gulf has been marked by frequent revolutions and more or less permanent oil wars. But what's happening now is not really that. This marks a different trend that emerged in Iran in 1979 with the Iranian Islamic Revolution tossing the brutal Shah from power. That revolt, the first truly Islamist uprising to control a major Middle Eastern country in many years, brutal itself, began the current period of fundamentalist Muslim movements and uprisings against autocratic dictators. Until recently, except in Iran and then later in Afghanistan for a while, most of them failed. The trend to radical Islam in the Middle East is fascinating and, well, weird, especially when viewed from the comfortably distant perspective of America and other Western democracies. The process is a three-stage one, I think. It sees areas, peoples, and nations long under the colonial rule of the Ottoman Empire and then the British Empire or the French Empire move first towards independence, almost always under the autocratic rule of a king, a general, a dictator, a sheikh, or a shah. Typically, these first-stage independent rulers were secular Muslims. Their personal religious convictions and practices might have been traditional. They ran their countries, nonetheless, on a secular model, and they brooked very little criticism from more orthodox or radical Islamists whom they usually imprisoned and often tortured. Usually, the rulers of these countries were quite corrupt financially, and the Muslim countries they ran were far from transparent or equitable. Although nearly every nation in the Middle East officially had democratic institutions, true power was always concentrated in the hands of the ruler and his small group of allies, always including the military. Eventually, the combination of corruption, inequity, and flat-out incompetence could not be consistently overcome by the brutality of these essentially police states. And so, first Iran, later Afghanistan, turned to radical Islamist leaders, who proved to be even more ruthless and brutal than the secular Muslim strongmen who preceded them. Many other revolts, rebellions, and revolutions have coursed through the Muslim Middle East over the years. Since 9/11, a continual state of actual war has existed between the U.S. and various Muslim entities. Since the Arab Spring, Islamist regimes have risen, and sometimes collapsed, in Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and elsewhere throughout the region. You know, the same thing occurred in Gaza a few years before, when the Islamists of Hamas, descended from the Muslim Brotherhood, forcibly expelled the secular Arabs of Fatah, the Palestinian Liberation Organization's descendants. So far, the military in almost every country has usually favored secular royals and dictators over Islamists. And that means that ultimately the Islamists are overthrown, or at least held at bay, as in Turkey. But even when they are stomped down by secular Muslim military authorities, these radical Muslims are playing on the inequity, corruption, and injustice ubiquitous in the Middle East. And that means there is always fertile ground for Islamists to cultivate new rebellions. That's true in every country in the Middle East. Well, except those like Iran and currently Libya, in which the Islamists already hold sway. That's just another form of the same messy problem. Except in one country. In fact, the only country in the entire Middle East in which this nasty dynamic is not being played out, with a great deal of American involvement most of the time, is, you guessed it, Israel. Israel has challenges, but it's a pretty darn robust Western democracy with a free press, free and egalitarian elections, the rule of law, protection for women, and a pretty fair distribution of wealth and power throughout society, at least compared to everybody else over there. Perhaps a little overall perspective on the region can help Americans understand that the conflict Israel has with Hamas in Gaza is just a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the larger Middle Eastern dynamic. That Islamist dynamic makes it a very complicated part of the world and promises trouble in some variation virtually every day on a much larger scale everywhere else in the whole area. And yet somehow, living in that really nasty neighborhood, Israel not only survives but thrives. In a way, this makes the success of Israel even more remarkable because its economy is not based on oil. Its government is not based on force, and its religious conflicts are played out not on battlefields or in torture chambers, but in the courts and the legislature and in the hearts and minds of its citizens, where they belong. As we approach Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, we can be very grateful for Israel's true exceptionalism in a very challenging region, and we can pray that this coming year of 5775 will bring an easier, better, more peaceful year to the Middle East. For Israel's sake, but also for America's sake, for our sake, and for the world's sake. Education is at the center of Jewish life and Jewish identity, but what's the best way to learn about Judaism? This morning, John Ben Asher, the head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy, will join us to discuss the Jewish day school movement, what day schools provide today, and what they will be like in the future. Find out when we return in a few moments, right here on Too Jewish. Join the Tucson Hebrew Academy as we celebrate and honor an all-around mensch, Pima County Supervisor Ray Carroll, on Sunday evening, November 2nd, 2014, at the JCC. Supervisor Carroll's tremendous contribution to THA as a board member and the work he's done as a great public servant for Tucson and Pima County is an inspiration to people of all faiths and backgrounds. Ray Carroll's commitment to our community is an example of how to make the world a better place. Also at this year's Tikkun Olam event, we're thrilled to welcome back world-renowned comedian, author, Two Jewish Radio Show guest, and Jewish Day School graduate, the very funny Joel Chasnoff, as MC and side-splitting entertainer. In addition to this hilarious comic and our worthy honoree, Tikkun Olam offers dinner, a silent auction, and a great opportunity to socialize. I can personally tell you, it's one of the best and most enjoyable evenings of the whole Tucson year. This is the Tucson Hebrew Academy's largest fundraiser. We'd love to have you join us. For tickets or sponsorship, call 529-3888, 529-3888, or visit our website, thaaz.org.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 15th anniversary with a special family class and in new locations. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. And we feed you too. Rabbis Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up, or go to our website, TempleEmmanuelTucson.org. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. It's free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But please, pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. Taste of Judaism has both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, East Tucson, and Green Valley, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today for Taste of Judaism.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, John Ben Asher. He is the head of Tucson Hebrew Academy, the Jewish day school here in Southern Arizona. And tell us what's unique about a Jewish day school education. Why should people think that's a good thing?
Absolutely. And first, I'd like to say thanks for having me today. And appreciate that, Rabbi Kohan. And hello, Jewish Tucson. What a great way to talk with you this morning. Definitely, Jewish day schools play a critical role in a community. And in a Tucson like ours, in a city like ours, which is very organized, a Jewish day school plays a key role. We are a community day school, which means that our model is one of pluralism and inclusion. We don't have a specific religious or synagogue affiliation type of a niche.
So not Orthodox, conservative, Reform,
exactly. You bet. We're here for all walks of life in terms of a Jewish perspective. And the role that it plays in the community is critical. We're talking about instilling Jewish values, living Jewish values. That's the mission of THA, teaching children to be menshes, the value of tikkun olam, repairing the world, giving back to the community, being engaged and involved, having a love of Judaism and living that love of Judaism through actions and deeds, practices, rituals, traditions, participation, etc. There's no better place to get a foundation like that in life than a Jewish day school.
Now, the majority of Jewish kids who are educated, who get a strong Jewish foundation, or get a Jewish foundation, don't end up going to a day school. They go to a supplemental school. They do it in a variety of other ways today. What's different about being in a day school than being in a supplemental school, doing it online,
sure,
whatever the different
absolutely.
Ways are that people get educated?
You know, and I have an interesting perspective on this because I went to the Tucson Hebrew Academy when I was a kid. So I can answer this from the point of an alumni, as well as, you know, current employee and a father, because my one of my daughters is now with us at THA. When you participate in a school environment that starts early in the morning and runs through the day, ends later in the day, after school offerings, etc., you're participating in a global experience. It's what you do all the time as a student. So this third of your life, if you will, is spent in this Jewish environment. Very different from sort of a supplemental experience kids might have if they participate in a Sunday program or an after-school program, which are also very important in our community. But what happens at THA is unique. For example, we have tefillah. We have prayers that accompany our lunchtime. Students have a full lesson of Hebrew, a full lesson of Judaics. And so being part of Jewish learning is instilled in all the things that are happening at a Jewish day school. So there's that sort of 360 experience that we're able to provide our kids.
We will talk much more about Jewish learning globally and about Jewish day schools with John Ben Asher when we return this morning on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174.
Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Remember, Rosh Hashanah begins September 24th this year, now just 4 days away, Wednesday night. It's time to make arrangements to attend services. My own Temple Emmanuel offers them to everyone at no charge. Be our guest is the theme, but you do have to pre-register by calling 520-327-4501. That's 327-4501 to attend the High Holy Days at Temple Emmanuel. We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, our expert from the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, and just about L'Shana Tova.
Boker Tov and Shana Tova.
Rosh Hashanah in Israel, obviously incredibly important to the Jewish community in America, but really considered kind of a synagogue festival. You dress up, you hear the shofar, you maybe have a family meal. Let's explore what Rosh Hashanah is like in Israel.
Yeah, so of course, beside the obvious that Rosh Hashanah being a high holiday also in Israel and the synagogue and everything, I don't know if you are familiar with the fact that Rosh Hashanah and also the Seder are the...
Passover.
Yeah, the Passover and Seder are the main causes for divorces in Israel.
Uh-oh. No, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, because twice a year, even the most loving couple will have the same conversation of where are we going to have this, you know, Rosh Hashanah meal. And Rosh Hashanah is more than, you know, it's a dinner and then it's lunch and then, you know, there is...
It's a lot of food. There's special foods, apples and honey, and there's special desserts that people make. And, you know, it's really a big deal.
And for some families that come from far away, like my brother, they don't live in Israel, in Beit She'an, so they need to schlep, like, and to come for 2 days. So, you know, so there is a lot of... Preparation and issues that so, and I'm not joking.
Like, no, I
there
understand.
Is so every year, I think after, I don't know if it's before or after Rosh Hashanah, but the
big spike in divorce rate goes up.
Yeah, but all the rabbis are familiar with the phenomena, so they will suggest Shlom Bayit, and by Pesach so everything will be good. But
then Pesach comes and they're ready to divorce again, and we need
so there
to
is
have
a lot of excitement in the Jewish families.
Great
in Israel.
Drama.
Which keeps the, you know,
keeps it from being boring.
Yeah, exactly.
So how many people would come to a Rosh Hashanah dinner at your home? In Israel?
No less than 40.
40?
No less than 40.
Wow, and I thought our seders were big because we have 30 or 35 people. So
my mother would laugh.
And your mother, I'm sure, made all of the special dishes by herself and maybe drafted you to do some.
Yeah, if we have like 20 seconds.
We do.
When my mother came here to United States and people that we invited for Shabbat dinner every week will ask, what can we bring? And she keep asking me,
What does this bring?
Why they need to bring? Bring their smiles and come. You know, that's it. This will be the regular answer. Bring your smile and come.
It's a great answer, and it's a great way to begin the new year. L'shana tova tikatevu v'techa tova.
Amen.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom, and this week, L'Shana Tova.
Good morning, Rabbi, and Happy New Year to you as well.
We were talking last week about the functionality of states in the Middle East, Israel sort of at the top of a not very competitive race to have the best governance. Let's talk about some of the other countries and whether they're even really functioning states.
Right. Well, many of the other countries are in danger of fragmenting either by region, geographically, by ethnicity. Lebanon has hardly ever been a functioning unified state. It's been characterized by decades and decades of civil war that was more or less above the surface and visible or below the surface, but hampered good governance. Syria has been plunged into this horrible civil war that's resulted in hundreds of thousands of casualties and displaced persons. It poses a big problem for Turkey, its major neighbor to the north.
Big problem for Jordan, where all the refugees have been pouring into.
Well, they poured into
also
Turkey
into
first.
Turkey too. That's right. Of course,
Iraq is a classic case. Iran is held together by force. It's not an Arab country, but it is a Muslim country that has significant minorities, either ethnic, linguistic, or religious. Not everybody there is Muslim. Certainly, not everybody there speaks Farsi. They have Armenians, they have Azeris, they have Zoroastrians, they have Baha'i. It's potentially a huge mess as well. And then we have other countries like Libya and Tunisia, where we first rejoiced when we saw signs of an Arab Spring, but many of those countries have devolved into complete messes. Countries that seem to be even remotely well-run are these tiny like constituent entities of the United Arab Emirates, these little Gulfy kingdoms or sheikhdoms, which are basically family businesses.
Big oil businesses with not very many people.
And good airlines that serve the whole world.
Isn't that
nice?
They
found an incredible airline model that has made hubs out of unlikely places like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, et cetera, Doha. And people going between, let's say, Houston and New Zealand can do so in two nonstops via these obscure or once obscure
Arab Emirate places,
capitals in the Middle East. Those countries have fairly effective governance because they're accountable. Everybody in the country knows each other. The sheikhs basically share the wealth. The nasty jobs are done by essentially South Asians, like Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis.
Used to be Palestinians,
Sri Lankans,
actually, up until the first Gulf War.
Right. Filipinos, et cetera, and they are treated a little better than slaves. So those countries are not necessarily models of human rights, except for people who were born there and who are actually citizens. But basically, when you look at this part of the world, there are hardly any countries that look like Switzerland or Costa Rica, to name a country closer to home, that are stable, democratic, moderate, good examples for what countries could evolve into. So you have a problem of instability, non-state entities which are committed to violence, and governments which are by and large too weak or too fractious or too disunified
or too corrupt
to combat effectively these non-state entities which cause them so much fear. So I'm sorry to sound like gloom and doom here, but it's not a bright picture right now.
You know, when people say that the Palestinian Authority is corrupt and ineffective, all they're really saying is it's an Arab state. I mean, it's almost universal in the region, and the hopes for improvement are just that. Tom, thanks. We will talk next year.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe gets a call from his lawyer insisting they meet at once. He rushes to his lawyer's firm and is brought into the office. "Do you want the bad news or the terrible news?" the lawyer asks. "Well, if those are my choices, I guess I'll take the bad news first." "Well," says his attorney, "your wife found a picture worth $500,000. "That's the bad news?" Abe is stunned. "Kinahara, if you call that bad news, I can't wait to hear the terrible news." And the lawyer answers, "The terrible news is that it's a picture of you and your secretary." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, on Thursday morning, we'll read a special Rosh Hashanah portion, the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, when God tests Abraham by having him almost but not quite sacrifice his son Isaac on a rock. As we remember the trauma of Isaac and the faith and struggle of Abraham, we know that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur we stand before God, open to the judgment that comes on Yom Hadin, the day of decision. May we come to know the openness that this judgment requires and so atone honestly for our sins and errors of the past year. Poet Chaim Guri has an interpretation of this tale from a very different direction. The translation here is by Tet Carmi, Alav HaShalom, may rest in peace. It's called Yerusha, heritage. The ram came last of all, and Abraham did not know that it came to answer the boy's question. First of his strength, when his day was waning, the old man raised his head, seeing that it was no dream and that the angel stood there, the knife slipped from his hand. The boy, released from his bonds, saw his father's back. Isaac, the story goes, was not sacrificed. He lived for many years, saw what was good in life, until his own eyesight dimmed. But he bequeathed that hour to his offspring. They are born with a knife in their hearts. A powerful and troubling message of testing and mortality in this holiest of seasons. We stand before God now, as Abraham and Isaac both did, and face a unique challenge. Knowing our mortal status, can we rise and affirm our essential holiness? In this season of repentance and return, we seek that holiness and to create justice in our world. And if we can, we will try to make goodness a natural consequence of each of our lives. Jewish day schools provide a quality education in a fully Jewish environment, but is their unique formula the right answer for the American Jewish community of the 21st century? Find out from John Ben Asher, the head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy, when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor.
Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 15th anniversary with a special family class and in new locations. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbis Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up, or go to our website, templeemmanueltucson.org. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. It's free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But please, pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. Taste of Judaism has both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, East Tucson, and Green Valley, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today for Taste of Judaism.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Yet another anti-Semitic attack rocked European Jewry last week when a synagogue in Belgium was set fire by arsonists. Police said the fire was deliberately set in 4 places in the temple on De La Clinique Street in Anderlecht, one of the municipalities that make up the Brussels region. The wife and 2 kids of the synagogue's caretaker who live in the building were treated for smoke inhalation. The caretaker was not there at the time of the arson. Last week's attack, part of an increase across Europe in anti-Semitic actions, was born on May 24th when a French-Algerian Muslim gunman killed 4 people at the Jewish Museum of Belgium in Brussels. So said Joel Rubenfeld, the president of the Belgian League Against Anti-Semitism. The museum shooting, similar to the March 2012 attack on the Jewish school in Toulouse, France, which left 3 children and a rabbi dead, that was perpetrated by a radical Muslim, a jihadist. Whatever the motivation for this particular attack, incidents of this nature only serve to cause further distress to the Jewish community both in Brussels and across Europe, said Pinchas Goldschmidt, the president of the Conference of European Rabbis. Brussels lawmaker Alain Destiche called on the government to develop a plan to fight anti-Semitism following these recent incidents. Anti-Semitism has reached an intolerable level in our capital. Within 3 days, we have witnessed the burning of the synagogue, missiles thrown at Jewish memorial visitors to Anderlecht, and anti-Semitic insults in a train in Jatte, he said. Last weekend at the National Memorial Site for Jewish Victims of the Holocaust in Belgium, also in Anderlecht, several people hurled stones and a bottle at the monument where 40 people or so were attending a memorial ceremony. And hours earlier, Belgian Prime Minister Elio De Rupo, in an address to the reopening of the Jewish Museum in Belgium in central Brussels, vowed to punish perpetrators of anti-Semitic crimes. More than ever before, fighting anti-Semitism must truly become a national cause. At stake is our country's honor and probably its future, he said. The attack in Brussels follows a recent attempted arson attack on a synagogue in Wuppertal, Germany, and the arrest of 2 Muslim girls who were planning to blow up the great synagogue in Lyon, France.
It is a new world.
Gwyneth Paltrow has long been considered a Jewish actress, at least by her fans and those in Hollywood who know that her late father, producer Bruce Paltrow, was Jewish. Gwyneth Paltrow's mother is Blythe Danner, the well-known actress, perhaps most prominent for her role in Will and Grace on TV or the movie Meet the Parents. But now, Gwyneth Paltrow has announced she has been in the process of a formal conversion to Judaism since discovering many of her ancestors were famous rabbis in Europe. This has led to confusion among many of us who thought she was already Jewish. Although she has long considered herself so, according to halacha, Jewish law, she would need to go through the process of passing a Beit Din, a Jewish legal court of rabbis, and being immersed in the mikveh, the ritual bath, to be formally considered so by Orthodox and conservative Jewish authorities. Apparently, Gwyneth Paltrow has been following Kabbalah for several years and is friends with Michael Berg, the co-director of the Kabbalah Center in L.A. Paltrow told an event hosted by the Jewish community in London that she wants to raise her children, Apple, 10, and Moses, 8, in a Jewish environment. She's appeared in about 50 films, won the Oscar as Best Actress for Shakespeare in Love, and also has an Emmy to her credit. She and her musician husband, Coldplay frontman Chris Martin, divorced earlier this year. Now, maybe she'll marry a nice Jewish man.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab.
A new statue of the late blues singer Amy Winehouse in London has the iconic figure wearing a Star of David. The unveiling last week in the Camden Town neighborhood of London, where Winehouse lived, marked what would have been her 31st birthday and was attended by her parents, among others. The statue has the singer, who was Jewish, striking a typical pose, one hand on her hip, the other clutching a miniskirt, topped by her famed bouffant hairdo, stuck with the statue's only burst of color, a red rose. Around Winehouse's neck is a Star of David set in a circle. Amy Winehouse died tragically of alcohol poisoning in 2011 at the age of 27. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. John Ben Asher is the head of Tucson Hebrew Academy, the Jewish day school here for Southern Arizona. John, we were talking earlier about what's special about Jewish day schools, how they differ. I want to extend that conversation a little bit. Many of us send our kids to camp in the summer, to Jewish camps.
Sure.
Send our kids to Israel in the summer. And what we love about it, or at least what the kids say they love about it, is, first of all, Judaism is cool. It's all day long. It's
right.
A natural outgrowth of their experience, where in an environment which is not enriched Jewishly in general, mm-hmm. most Jews live in places in which they're in a small minority in America.
Not surrounded by other Jews all the time.
Not surrounded by Jews, not surrounded, and if they are, not necessarily with Jews who experience Jewish practice and ritual
right,
and
right.
prayer as fulfilling necessarily, or don't see it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
How? Tell us how Jewish day school differs from a Jewish camp experience. Have they become closer together over the years?
It's a great question. And, you know, I also had the good fortune growing up of going to Camp Ramah.
Right.
And one of the things that I always felt as a personal mission for me in my work as a career educator was to make school a little campy where you can because of that Ramah experience and JCC summer camp experience, too. The difference is you're in a much more academic setting, of course, and there, you know, at a summer camp you might have chugim, clubs and groups you can do, more of an enrichment and an extension, and you know, at school there's an academic focus, and of course we span two genres at school in terms of educational content. We're dealing with a secular education and the critical need to make that robust and challenging and strong, and as well a Jewish education, also wanting that to be robust and strong experience for our kids. So there's the whole spectrum of learning that's taking place. You know, fortunately, when you're at summer camp, you don't have to take an end of the unit test. You're
no,
not
you
getting
don't.
Grades and things like that. So, you know, the setting is a little more structured, a lot more structured and focused. But yet the parallels are very rich because you still get that living Judaism experience. One of the things we do at THA every 2 weeks is we have an all-school Shabbat lunch. And the kids get to sit at a table with a staff member and a child from each grade level. So we do family style seating. And it feels different. It's the Sabbath. It's sacred. It's got this holiness to it and something that's special. And you get that at camp. You can also get that at THA. So there are some nice parallels in terms of what a day school offers.
You know, one of the challenges, Jewish day schools used to be, first of all, denominationally limited. And when I was growing up, there were Orthodox day schools. And
sure.
The Solomon Schechter movement was the conservative day school movement was kind of going. There weren't such things as Reform day schools when I was younger.
Still and out they, there. Absolutely. All
they,
denominations.
They came out, and there are some very effective places. But however they're constructed, the competition, which used to be, do you want to send your kid to a day school or do you want them to go to a supplemental school, is now much more complicated with charter school movement.
Right.
Tell us, for a Jewish day school to succeed today in this really different kind of academic environment in the United States, all over the country, what are the priorities?
There are a lot of components that Jewish day schools need to be successful in communities. First of all, you've got to have your community support, which needs to be organized and consistent. And that means interacting with the community, getting people on board, sharing the mission and the vision and the values of the school, obtaining buy-in from the Jewish community. Without Jewish Tucson supporting our day school, we'd be in real trouble. So having that community support is critical, and it comes from our religious organizations as well as other Jewish community agencies. So that sense of partnership, that sense of place at the table. We're a K-8 system, and so we occupy a very unique niche and a critical niche in the lives of children and families and where we are as a society here in Tucson. So you need that community support.
K-8, that's the period of time when you like your children and then they become teenagers? Is that
Well, that's always, you know, circumstantial, but yes, in theory.
This may be a little too confessional right here.
So, you know, there's more to the picture than community support, although that's a key ingredient. You also need to have buy-in and participation from your families. We offer this family experience, and part of it is having parents on campus, having parents part of the volunteer programs that happen at school, putting on the Shabbat lunch I just mentioned. That's all, you know, run, served by parents. With, of course, help from staff, but it's a great volunteer group of parents that come to that. So you need family support, parent involvement, and of course you need kids. And it's interesting because as a community school, we have kids coming to us from all walks of life in Tucson.
Right. Right.
And so our job is to make sure that we have the resources that they need. We are working with the right community agencies and organizations to support our mission and to kind of bring it all together at the school.
So let's talk a little bit about the understanding of responsibility, communal responsibility that comes with going to a Jewish day school, especially a community day school. Not only are you teaching values, I think all schools today try to teach values. I'm startled by the amount of values instruction in public school compared to what it was when I, you know.
Character education, I think it's called in a lot of places.
Boy, they didn't really do it that way when I was in school back in many years ago. But in addition to that, there's a commitment not only to doing that in a Jewish way, in a Judaic values, but also to giving back to the community. Can you explore some of that?
Sure, you bet. And again, coming back to our mission statement, to educate Jewish youth so that they are able to go forward in the community and live Jewish lives. And it's interesting because, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, and I am part of the first graduating generation of students from THA. And we are now in the leadership roles and, you know, the hitting that time in our careers where we are experienced in the field and know the work intimately. So the product of a child who comes from an environment like THA is one where hopefully there's a sense of purpose, there's a sense of mission and urgency to give back to the community, to look out for all of the members of the community, both our Jewish family and beyond, but to stay connected, to stay involved, and to give back. We have a Tikkun Olam event every year, and you know, repairing the world is one of the key values that we instill in our kids as well. So kids who come out of THA have the potential to be leaders in the community, to play an active role, to know and be able to do some of the important things that leadership is all about. They can articulate, they can communicate, they have initiative, but there's a moral fiber, there's a moral purpose that's also part of that what you take away when you graduate from THA.
So I'm going to ask a hard question, because the truth is, in addition to free public schools, there are charter schools all throughout Arizona and in many parts of the country and, of course, parts of the world where our listening audience comes from. And they know that they don't have to pay to register kids for those schools.
Sure.
So there's a major scholarship program at Tucson Hebrew Academy that I know is true for other Jewish community schools, but right. Talk about that a little bit, about how, because of course there is a tuition.
Absolutely. You know, as a private school, we are responsible for developing and maintaining our own budget. We don't have some of the same funding sources that traditional schools do. And by the way, I love hard questions, so never hesitate, even on the air. We have a robust...
That's what it means to be Jewish, is to ask hard questions. And not necessarily answer them.
That's right. Well, you got to try. So... we have a robust scholarship program, and many of our listeners have probably heard of JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Arizona is one of three states where individuals and companies, for that matter, can donate funds that are usable for tuition in private schools. And if you make that kind of a donation, you're literally getting a dollar for dollar tax credit. So anybody that's paying taxes to the state of Arizona is eligible to participate in this program. And the JETCO dollars are awarded by a JETCO board. And the dollars don't just go to THA, they also go to other Jewish educational organizations in Tucson. So the community in total benefits tremendously from this program. And an education at THA is not free, but it is highly valuable. And we maintain that every penny of that investment comes back over the course of a lifetime in big ways.
And I have to say, the Jewish value of education and the value we have always put on education, sponsoring education, certainly still rings true for Jewish parents.
Sure, you bet.
All over.
You know, and we take the stance of finances should never get in the way of a Jewish kid getting a Jewish education. And so we work hard to scholarship families. We also, you know, we also want families to be participating in the tuition process. So we work closely on an individual basis to determine what's right, what's fair, what meets the family's needs, what balances out with the school's needs, and how do we get this done.
I want to thank John Ben Asher for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And how can people find out more about Tucson Hebrew Academy specifically and Jewish
Day
School education?
You bet. Well, you can, of course, find us online, thaaz.org, or Google us. We should pop up. Also, you're welcome to come visit the school. You can also give me a call. My phone number is 870-6819. That's my cell phone. I hand that out for work. I'm perfectly comfortable if you give me a call. So what I like to say is call, click, or visit. We're out there. We'd love to talk to you. And thanks for the opportunity, Rabbi Cohen.
You're very welcome, John, and the Shana Tova. Good and a healthy new year.
Healthy new year for all.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the author and activist Anita Diamant, writer of The Red Tent and many other outstanding books on Judaism. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from Israeli singer Yehudit Ravitz, continuing a theme we began last night at Slichot Services, Apologies for Errors. Her song is called, fittingly, Slichot, and it should help us get ready for Rosh Hashanah this coming Wednesday night and Thursday, September 24th and 25th. You can call Temple Emmanuel, 520-327-4501. If you wish to attend, there is no charge, but you have to pre-register. My friends, L'shana tova tikatevu v'techa temu, may be written and sealed in the Book of Life for a good year, and may you and your family have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, and a coming new year, we pray, of peace. Lechol ris v'tzipor.